checking for me, no one checking on me. So I had to go run up a check. I got a message, homie, you know, flexing on me. My attorney will call and collect. Blessings on blessings for me. Hey, hey, hey. How's everyone doing out there? I hope you're doing well. I didn't even give you a chance to answer. I hope you're doing well. I feel silly asking, but I feel like that's the normal interaction. Ask how people are doing. So I hope you're doing well. This is Simon for the Closing Network podcast, episode number 14. I have really enjoyed doing the last couple episodes with The Hated One. We are actually recording another podcast later this afternoon together. I'll be posting that. So I'll always be sure to include that in the description so you know which ones are which. Still getting a lot of questions, and I'm not totally surprised because I have a lot of questions as well around mobile devices. So I wanted to give an update. As I've mentioned in the previous episode with The Hated One, that I did switch back to Graphene OS on my Google Pixel 6 Pro for my main phone, my main daily driver, and I have been loving it. So I did switch away from Calyx OS just a couple of weeks ago. Well, it's probably been a few weeks now, and back to Graphene OS. And the reason for that is not because I don't like Calyx OS or I don't think it's great. I do. I have it on yet another device because I like to stay up to date with everything and understand the differences and the nuance between the two different ROMs. So these are de-Googled operating systems that will run on your Pixel devices. I know that Graphene OS is working to be compatible with other devices that are non-Pixels, but right now the Pixels seem to work the best, ironically enough. So why did I switch back? Because I wanted to see how well this Google Play environment, Google services within a sandboxed environment worked on the phone, as opposed to using the Aurora Store with Micro G on Calyx OS. A few things of note is that the development seems quite a bit more rapid for Graphene OS. Now, granted, they have a smaller footprint as far as the ROM that gets loaded. So they're not pre-installing it with a bunch of apps that Calyx OS does. Now, when you install Calyx OS, you have the option to install them, but you know, these are apps that you're most likely going to install anyway, like F-Droid, Aurora, and some of the other apps that you might want, like KeePass XC. I think there's a handful of others. I just don't know them off the top of my head. And I'm saying, you know, VPN client and thing you probably wouldn't care for if you have your own VPN client. I've been using Proton VPN and iVPN for quite a long time. Of course, you can also install Orbot, which will run specific apps through Tor. Highly recommend checking that out. So the issue I was having with Calyx OS running on my main phone was that I wouldn't get automatic updates out of Aurora for some of the applications I had installed because the Aurora app itself would need to be updated, which you do through F-Droid. So I would be trying to use an app and it wouldn't load, like a banking app to deposit a check is a great example. It wouldn't load because the app was out of date. So I try to load it in Aurora. Aurora's out of date. I got to go to F-Droid and update Aurora there first. Then I can go update the app to use the app. Now, when you increase your privacy and your security, these types of things are going to happen. You're going to have some challenges in the way that you need to, you know, just accept and or find a workaround, but just accept and just say, okay, it's not a trillion-dollar corporation that's behind this operating system that's trying to make my life easy. They are, you know, trying to make your life easy, but it's very challenging. So this isn't the fault of Calyx OS or Graphene. Like, some of these nuances or struggles or challenges that you'll run into are not like their fault. They have limited resources. They have limited developers and they're doing the very best they can. And that is actually really good. They're both fantastic operating systems, and I think they equally have, you know, their own pros and cons, and there's merit to picking one or the other. But the other issue I was having is that Micro-G is always kind of seeming to trailing a little bit behind, and that makes sense. You're kind of having to reverse engineer and provide updates. You're relying on another team, the Micro-G team, to push those updates out. Those updates get rolled into the next build of Calyx OS or their iterative updates. So it just felt like it was a little lagging because there's more pieces that need to connect together. Whereas Graphene OS has this, what they call, you know, their sandboxed Google Play, and it basically is three different apps that get installed, which is the Google Services Framework, the Google Play Services, and the Google Play Store. They're installed inside of an app that comes stock with Graphene OS. You don't have to install this. You don't have to use this. If you want to be ultra hardened, I recommend not even, you know, trying it out. Really, you don't need it. But if you're someone like me that does rely on things for work, certain applications, you need those notifications and you need those apps to be updated as quickly as they are released into the Google Play Store, then this might be the better route for you. Now, the way that I've read multiple times the Sandbox Google Play section under the usage page on the graphenos.org website to wrap my head around it. And to distill it down, I mean, I can read a couple of paragraphs because I think it might be helpful. So basically, Graphene OS has a compatibility layer providing the option to install and use the official release of Google Play and the standard app sandbox. So Google Play receives no particular special privileges on your Graphene OS phone as opposed to bypassing the app sandbox and receiving like access to privilege areas of your phone. So the compatibility layer teaches it how to work within the full app sandbox. It isn't used as a backend for the operating system service itself, like it would be on a stock Android phone. So Graphene OS doesn't use Google Play even when it's installed. Think of it as kind of like running it in a virtual machine, if that makes sense. So think of like whatever your host operating system, let's say you're running Windows or you're running Linux and you install VirtualBox and you can install whatever operating system you want in there and whatever applications you want in there. And it's not accessing your host machine directly. Now, the cool thing is that it works really seamlessly, just like a lot of, if you've heard of VMware or VirtualBox, where you can copy and paste from one OS to the other. You can allow access to be shared back and forth, but Google Play itself, the store, and the apps are not directly accessing the operating system. I think that's kind of the best way to explain it, and I don't know if that's even 100% sure. I'm still learning this. I'm just trying to explain it in a way that would make sense if I were explaining it to myself, and I was unfamiliar with how it works because I am a techie, but this kind of goes into another layer of development that you kind of need to be able to wrap your head around. So since Google Play apps are simply just regular apps on the phone, and you can install them in your main profile or you can create a separate profile and install those apps over there. So maybe let's say you have like your Graphene OS personal profile. You can set up another profile for work, install those apps over there. So maybe you need Outlook or maybe you need specific 2FA app or, you know, who knows? Maybe you even need a social media app installed or maybe you rely on LinkedIn, but you don't want to compromise your phone by installing these intrusive apps that do not respect your privacy and try to harvest contact information, call logs, text messaging, all those things. A lot of these apps try to harvest that information and send it back to the mothership. To use for correlating other people in your network. I mean, it's not all evil. It's just the way the business models are set up. So everything we talk about on this podcast, not everything, but a lot of the things that we talk about on this podcast are ways to protect your personal identity, your digital life. So if you've listen to my previous episodes, where whether it's email addresses, password managers, using tools like privacy.com to make purchases online and shield your identity, or also limit the possibility of your credit card being hijacked and used by a scammer or something like that. That is always the main focus. Like we talked about threat models in the previous episode, number 13, with the hated one, identifying your threat models. And most of my threat model, and I think a lot of people that listen to the show, are just trying to limit their footprint of exposure of their personal data to big tech companies. Not necessarily trying to avoid nation states or governments, but although that also will be reduced by using a lot of these tools. So far, it's been working out really well for me. I'll kind of talk about one instance with the banking stuff. If you install Calyx OS and you go to the Aurora store and you try to find any financial apps like Cash App, Venmo, Splitwise, some of these financial apps, they oftentimes aren't found. And that's because the server, from what I understand, the Aurora server that's actually pulling those APK files from the Google Play Store anonymously for you is in France, I believe. So when it's querying the Google Play Store for apps like Bank of America app, for example, or a credit card app for American Express or something that you may need on your device, maybe you travel a lot and you this is imperative to have, it can't find those because it doesn't have the right build, or they're restricted based on the country that it thinks you're in. Now, you can get around that in Aurora by going into your network setting and basically de-anonymizing yourself to a degree. You can change the location from where you're being, and then you have to log out of Aurora, log back in, and then you can find those apps. It's not that you can't do these things, it's just there's more steps. And if you're not super savvy about that and no one's explained it to you, then you don't know, you think something's wrong or it doesn't work. And with running the hardened Graphene OS with the Google Play sandbox environment, it's almost as if you're just, it feels, the user experience is very similar to if you were using a stock Android phone where you just open up, you're actually just installing everything from the Google Play Store. And it's so well integrated that if you do want to sign in with your account, you can even access apps you've paid for. And you can even pay for apps. So if any apps with in-app purchases, this will work on Graphene OS, which is pretty amazing to me. Now, people in the forum even said they are using Google Pay. I haven't tested that. I don't really plan to. That's not really a use case for me. I carry my credit cards in my wallet. I'm actually carrying a new wallet. I've been traveling a bit, and I purchased an RFID blocking wallet from what is the website? Let me look it up real quick. It's called GoDark, I think. GoDark Bags. No affiliation. I paid for them. The reason why I like buying from them is because they accept cryptocurrency. So yeah, GoDarkBags.com. And they have EMF signal blocking, which is really important to me for shielding my credit cards information. All of our credit cards, most all new ones, have RFID scanners in there or chips. So that's what allows you to do the wave and pay, like the wireless contactless payment. So I have several of their Faraday bags, one for an iPad, for my iPhone when I travel. But they also have great, like, around-the-waist ones if you travel internationally. You want to keep your passport and your credit cards and everything secure from people that could get close enough to you to potentially scan and pull that credit card information wirelessly off your cards. I highly recommend checking them out, or any Faraday bag. I'm not promoting just them. Again, I've been purchasing from them for like the last few years because they accept cryptocurrency and their bags work really well. I like the material. They don't look like anything. They look like just a bag, like a pouch. It doesn't scream like, hey, I'm a Faraday bag, I'm a weirdo. They're very subtle and they look very professional, and they just look like, you know, something that you would put your device in to keep it protected more than you would from it not being able to broadcast any signals or be scanned. So why did I go there. I just lost my train of thought. The wallet. Yeah, so they have a wallet actually out now, and I picked one of those up, and it's pretty cool. It has a money clip on one side, which is nice. I like to carry a little bit of cash on me for like tips and things like that, or you know, parking or whatever. And then the cards inside, it holds about 6 or 7, and it shields them from being scanned. So you know, I'm always trying to implement things in my life that will limit my exposure. Does it make me 100%? Could I still get mugged? Yeah, sure, of course. Like, I'm not invincible by doing these things. It's just little incremental steps to take to try to reduce those attack vectors that a lot of scammers or hackers or criminals will exploit to enhance, you know, or to make, you know, take money or whatever, take advantage of people. So I just wanted to give an update because I know I had mentioned it with the Hated One on the previous podcast that I had switched to Graphene OS. Part of it is also I do like how hardened Graphene OS is, and there's a lot less that comes with the ROM out of the box. So it just seems like, I don't know, I seem to have less issues overall. Now, I'm not saying don't use Calyx OS. That's not at all what I'm saying. I like to try everything. I mean, who knows? I'll probably flip around a couple more times. I kind of easily also get not bored, but just curious. So maybe Calyx OS will come out with something new and I'll be like, hey, let me try that for a while. Though I kind of hate setting up my phone over and over again, it does make it a little easier because most of my content, my contacts and files and all that stuff are in my Nextcloud server. One bummer thing is that the Vance D app has been stopped. They've had to stop development. For those that don't know what Vance D, V-A-N-C-E-D, is, it was kind of like this really cool isolated install. The website was vancedapp.com, and I'll actually just read what they said on their website. Is no longer available. Because, well, I don't see, it's not on their website at the moment. I have to dig for it. But basically, YouTube was like, you can't do that. And I think they threatened them. Basically, you can install the app and have almost like YouTube Premium for free, where you could have the video playing in the background. You had access to the music without a subscription. It would skip ads, and it would even do the sponsor blocking, which was a really slick feature because a lot of YouTube creators will have their ad in the video itself rather than a Google ad that you can skip playing before the video or during the video. It actually just, they do sponsor spots. So it would even detect that and skip through. I did actually, I don't know if this is right or wrong, but this is what I'm doing. I have a copy of that APK file and I uploaded it. And I will have a link in the show notes for anyone that wants it. It's so far still working. I don't know how long it'll work for, but it does work. And for those that want kind of the same experience on their desktop computers, I also will have some links in the show notes because there are ways to get around, you know, YouTube Premium. I find that either using the Brave browser or using Firefox with uBlock Origin installed. And then also there's a extension called Sponsor Block, kind of provides a very good experience, be able to skip, you know, bypass ads and bypass the sponsor segments within those videos. Morally, ethically, you know, is this right or wrong? I'm not going to get into it. I'm just putting it out there. So that Vance D app will be available for download. I'll have a link in the description. It's on ufile.io. You know, download and use software. It's your, you know, using good judgment. I directly uploaded this APK file and uploaded it here. Basically, installs its own little version of MicroG, and then you can install both or just one or the other of the YouTube music or the YouTube video app itself. This would be basically like if you wanted to log into your Google account, have access to your playlists and like and comment on things, but also have a YouTube Premium experience without paying for it. That's what this provided. The project is, like I said, dead in the water now. The current build does still work. I'm using it on my Graphene OS Pixel Pro, but it may not work once YouTube makes some changes down the road. If and when that happens, I mean, that'll be a bummer. I'll uninstall it. You can use mobile browsers to kind of accomplish the same thing. I won't get into that heavy at the moment. I might talk about that at a different time. I wanted to also talk about this acquisition of Simple Login by ProtonMail. So for those that don't know or unaware, ProtonMail has purchased Simple Login. And at first I was like, well, that's interesting. You know, like maybe that's cool. That's a cool feature. But I'm also kind of skeptical sometimes because these are two of my recommendations and have been for a very long time. Simple Login is an email aliasing service, so you can, and it's free. You can sign up for it and create email aliases, kind of like what Apple does. If anyone's familiar with Apple on iOS, they have a hide my email feature that came out with iOS 15. Basically, it just creates a fake email. So if that site, or I should say when that site or service is compromised and they get access to all these accounts, you will only have ever used that one email address with that one service, and they won't be able to correlate it to other accounts that they may have access to in their data troves. It also helps reduce and limits the amount of spam that you receive in your inbox because it's this aliased email, and it still comes to your email. But typically, when you sign up for a service, they send you the email to validate that that is your real account and that you can have access to reset your password and these types of things. And once you do that, you're typically not really wanting to receive email from them. So now it's like they just use it as a marketing tool to send you their monthly email newsletter. So they have been around, Simple Login's been around since 2019. And according to this article on Fossbytes, they have grown to 1 million users. And they have over 2 million email aliases that have been created through them and growing. So they're like double-digit rate growth each and every month. So it looks like ProtonMail is acquiring them, and maybe there's some cool stuff that they'll do to incorporate the functionality of those email aliases. It sounds like they're going to kind of still keep them as two separate applications or projects, but I would imagine that at some point ProtonMail has a roadmap to integrate their technology into their own email platform. ProtonMail already allows you to create email aliases, but only so many per paid account. So maybe that's one of the things that they're looking at is this kind of like how Apple has this hide my email system, is that they can kind of have a similar, more seamless creation of these email aliases using the simple email application right inside your ProtonMail app or something similar to like what Apple uses with theirs, their Hide My Email. Not really sure. So on the surface, I'm like, yeah, this sounds really cool. Like I use ProtonMail and I use Simple Login, so this could be really, really neat. On the downside, I'm not a big fan of centralizing all of those types of features to one company. And ProtonMail is a company. We trust people, companies like this, as far as we can throw them. But we trust that by paying for the service that they are on our side as far as not selling our data, not allowing access to our data without notifying us, and you know, looking out for our best interest from a privacy standpoint. Simple Login is kind of the same thing. So if they're acquiring them and incorporating it and they can kind of hold true to that ethos, then I am excited. But I also know that sometimes when companies go through these acquisitions and grow, they're trying to provide a lot more functionality, which makes sense, makes it more appealing for people to use their service. But it can also make me a little concerned, thinking like, well, now all my email aliases and my email are with one provider. So is that what I like, or do I want to try something else or whatever? It's a little too soon to make that judgment call. I just don't always put all my eggs in one, like putting my eggs in one basket. I was actually having a conversation with my mom yesterday, and she all of a sudden started receiving spam text messages over the last few days, and with group chats of like 19, 20 people in there. I was like, yeah, definitely don't click on anything. And of course, they did send a URL. And so I walked her through kind of setting up a phone number using the MySudo app. The reason why I bring this up is because MySudo is a great privacy tool. for creating pseudo accounts for yourself that have email and phone numbers that you can receive text, phone calls, and that kind of thing. They also have virtual credit card functionality. And I haven't tried it, and it's not because I don't think it probably works great. It probably does. I just prefer to break my transactions out amongst different providers. So I still use privacy.com. No affiliation, no sponsorships. I use these services. That's why I talk about them. So I can kind of know, like, I can feel a little bit better knowing that, like, I only do my virtual credit cards through privacy.com. I only use my pseudo for the email aliasing and the phone numbers. So they're not all tied together, if that makes sense. My pseudo doesn't know what, you know, virtual credit card numbers I'm using with which email address and which phone number. At least they don't know where the transaction is happening. It's not that I don't trust my pseudo. Again, I don't trust anybody. So you kind of like have this mindset of like trust no one and all this kind of stuff. And I don't mean to make it sound very dark or dystopian. It's just, you know, operational security recommendations are to compartmentalize as much as possible. So when a lot of these services start trying to provide the same features that you've or I have been using over a period of time, I start to get a little, not suspect, right? Because they are also trying to provide the best product possible that's all-encompassing. And maybe most people are comfortable with that. And it's not that I'm uncomfortable. It's just my operational security, my OPSEC is set up so that I don't have a single point of failure, or I try to limit the single point of failure when it comes to a data breach or a hack. So if my pseudo gets hacked, they won't have any of my financial information. If privacy.com gets hacked, they don't have access to my email aliases that I use or phone numbers that I use with those numbers. You know what I'm saying? Like, I kind of try to like keep it separate. Now, that definitely makes it a little more inconvenient. That's for sure. But it just, you know, kind of helps reinforce the potential outcome or limit the potential blowback or danger that I could receive in the event that one of these services is breached or hacked or, I don't know, maybe even taken down, you know, by some government mandate or something like that. So anyway, it's just news, and it's just something I wanted to mention, because if you use ProtonMail and or Simple Login, then it's good to know what's happening in the privacy world where these companies are making moves and how that might impact us over time. So I'll have a couple of links to two different news articles in there if anyone is curious to check that out. So another interesting thing of note, since we're on the topic of news, is that apparently there has been a lot of Facebook users that have been locked out of their accounts. And this happens pretty regularly. People might log into their account and they'll see a pop-up that says, "We cannot review the decision, you know, to disable your account." So they'll disable your account because it didn't follow community standards. But they often don't tell you what standard or guideline you broke. It could have just been posting a funny meme. And what happens is that there's usually no warning when this happens. It just happens. And you might see people post screenshots like, "Oh, I got, you know, delete, you know, put in Facebook jail," or this and that and the other. But now they're actually locking people out of their accounts, and they're not emailing them saying why. And they're saying that the decision can't be reversed. So there was an article on the BBC where a user, you know, was told, you know, there was no warning or explanation given. They just, you know, said, "Well, you aren't following the community standards." So why do I bring this up? If you are one of these people that still has your Facebook account and you like to stoke the coals, stoke the fire, whether it's religion or science or politics or any of this kind of stuff, you might just want to be aware that these things can happen where you might often just be put in timeout for a day or 3 days or 5 days or a week or 30 days. But there could be a time, and there's no documentation I could find that says like after so many violations or anything, but there could be a time where you actually get locked out to the point where you'll no longer have access to your account or the content. So if you're one of these people that kind of uses Facebook as a place for your memories and your photos because you're posting them there and you're not downloading those or you don't have access to them anywhere else, you could potentially be embargoed from your own content that you've posted on Facebook or Meta now over the last, you know, decade or 15 years or however long you've had an account there. So let this just kind of be, you know, a warning sign, whether you're using Instagram or Facebook or any of these other, you know, media, social media sharing sites, that your content is yours, but when you upload it to one of their platforms, it is now theirs. It's their data and it lives on their servers. And if you violate their terms of service, they can cut you off at any moment. This even goes for Google. This goes for Apple. They're, you know, not that I've seen this happen or at least articles on it happening, but it could happen. It could happen down the road. If it's happening with Facebook and Instagram, then why wouldn't it happen with Google Photos or with Apple iCloud if you're in violation? And I'm not saying even from like a criminal standpoint. It could just be your dank collection of memes that make fun of big tech or make fun of the president or whatever the context is. If it's not stored somewhere where you control, then there is a potential for it to be not accessible by you down the road if they, for some reason, find that you're in violation of their community guidelines or their terms of service. I just want people to be in the mindset and understand that when you're using these services and this data is being stored on their servers, that it's not yours. So I talk a lot about self-hosting, you know, like Nextcloud or even just some of these off-the-shelf network attached storage, you know, devices that you can buy from your, you know, consumer electronic stores like Best Buy or whatever, Fry's and stuff like that, would even be a better option where you can run it at home and you can sync your files locally to a device that you control. Maybe once every 3 months, make a copy of it and keep that copy at another family or friend's you know, house in the event of a fire or something. You don't lose all your stuff. Unless you have, you know, another Nextcloud server at another person's house, you can actually sync them. You can actually back them up offsite to the other Nextcloud server. Now, that does take a little more technical implementation to do like a Nextcloud setup, but there are some pretty decent consumer off-the-shelf solutions that you can do yourself. I know Western Digital has something called, I think, MyCloud, which is, first of all, just get the word cloud out of here. It's just basically, all it is a computer, a hardware device. So cloud just means it's just like somebody else's computer, right? So you can have your own, which is, you know, running in your home or your office or wherever and be backing this stuff up. I just want to kind of instill that mindset into people where you are in control of your information, your photos, your documents. So if you rely on Google Drive or Dropbox, well, you have vulnerabilities in that those could be compromised, but you could also lose access, especially if you don't pay, because some of these require you to pay a premium service every month. Dropbox, I think, is like $10 or $12 a month. You know, and then it all depends on how much storage you have. So if you look at what you spend per month over the course of a year or two, you could easily use that money to run your own infrastructure. And it could just be older hardware that you have laying around. And I'll kind of get into more self-hosting topics down the road on other episodes. But I just kind of want to just plant that seed in the back of your head where if it's not in my control, then I don't always get to dictate how I get to use it in the future or how somebody else uses it. And this is a great example. So this is kind of where I'm talking about with, you know, talking about the whole Proton Mail simple login thing. It's like, well, you know, if I rely on them for doing all my email and now my email aliasing, if, you know, they have a technical glitch or some sort of vulnerability, how does that impact me? So I'm not saying go delete your simple login or Proton Mail. No, not at all. Not at all. I'm not saying that. It's just be aware. And, you know, as I see anything that is important enough to mention, I'll definitely be talking about it on the podcast. So What else is going on? So there's some interesting updates with privacy legislation. There's, you know, some of it sometimes is, you know, looked at as like, oh, hey, more privacy legislation. This is a good thing. Sometimes can be good. And Utah is now the fourth state as of mid-March, last month. Today is April 11th. They passed a bill, 227, which is also known as the Utah Consumer Privacy Act, or UCPA. And this is what they call a comprehensive bill, similar to that of California, Virginia. There's also one in Colorado. And it's supposed to take effect, if enacted, you know, it's supposed to take effect at the end of next year. So end of December 2023. And so, what exactly is it supposed to provide? It's supposed to provide right to access, meaning consumers have the right to confirm that the business is processing their personal data and access the data. So as the user, being able to access it, and also right of deletion. So consumers have the right to delete their personal data they provided to the business. Also, the right to portability. So consumers would have the right to obtain a copy of the data that the business controls. And it's got to be portable in a way that can be transmittable to the business or the individual. And then also a right to opt out. So consumers have the right to opt out of the processing of their data for purposes of targeted advertising or the sale of their data. So I'm always trying to find deeper information with anything that's legislative that, you know, relates to security or privacy in this case. But I do like where this is going. It does look like there's some, you know, and the criteria for this is businesses that generate $25 million a year in annual revenue. So if you're a startup or something, it wouldn't apply. If you're a small business, it wouldn't apply until you reach the threshold of that $25 million annually as far as your revenue. So I kind of feel good. There's also a violation, which isn't super high, but there is a $7,500 proposed violation for damages if they are not, you know, that people can seek for statutory damages if they are breaking this this law. So I like to see this, at least that legislators are looking at companies. Like, if you notice, remember back in the day where, you know, depending upon how old you are, it used to be a pain in the butt if you wanted to switch cell phone providers because you'd have to change your number. And then they, you know, passed this law, and I don't remember it off the top of my head, but basically it needed to make your phone number portable because it was part of your identity, it was part of your information, and so you should be able to take that phone number and move it to another carrier. The carriers have made it kind of like hard sometimes, but you know, as long as you have like your account number and your PIN number to your account, it's fairly easy and seamless to move your phone number from one service provider, whether it's Verizon to T-Mobile or AT&T to Mint Mobile, you know, so on and so forth. So I kind of like to see that they're including this data portability feature, if you will call it a feature of the law, where the consumer has a right to, you know, have a copy of that data and moved somewhere else. Because let's say you're using, maybe it's, you know, it could be any number of services, but you know, it could be personal health data. It could be anything, I guess, as long as it meets the criteria of them being a $25 million a year revenue per year business that they have to require to supply your data if requested, delete the data requested, and move the data if you request and opt out from the sale of your data, especially if the purpose is for targeted advertising. It's a small step, but it's a step in the right direction. I would like to see this happen in more states. I would like to see even a little bit more aggressiveness on this and the criteria, where I think the $25 million a year is a little high. I think that in this day and age, anyone starting any kind of business should have some expectations for protecting the information of their consumers, of their clients. So I hope to see this as a trend moving forward. But you know, props to Utah for, you know, at least making that first step. And I guess there are other states as well. I think there's 30 states that have introduced similar bills. Indiana, Florida, Oklahoma. Of course, this only applies to the United States. So if you're across the pond, you probably have your own. And oftentimes, European countries have even a lot of these already, or at least they're on their way to. They seem to be a little further ahead than the United States as far as privacy legislation and privacy protection laws. So we'll keep a lookout for that. And as things, you know, other states come on board and adopt this kind of policy, we just want to make sure that it's not infringing on people's privacy. But oftentimes the companies are already doing that. So to see some protection start to become to the forefront is really positive. So I didn't have a whole lot of other things because I'm going to be doing another podcast this afternoon with the Hated One. And we're going to be talking about, for those that are interested, we're going to talk a little bit more about blockchain and cryptocurrencies. And we're also going to talk about alternatives to mainstream platforms for media consumption. So like instead of YouTube, we'll be talking about Odyssey and, you know, BitChute. There's a couple others. I can't keep up with them all. I know there's like Gab. There's another big popular one, and I'm just drawing a blank right now off the top of my head. But why? So when we do this content, we put them out on these mainstream sites, and one of the comments is like, why are you guys not doing this on Odyssey or embracing some of these decentralized platforms? A lot of people that are already on these decentralized platforms are already kind of enlightened and understand what the trade-offs are when they use Google or Apple or Facebook and Microsoft services or Amazon services. So you know, the goal is to try to reach as broad of an audience as possible and just enlighten them to knowing that there are trade-offs when you're using, especially a lot of these air quote free services like, you know, YouTube. And, you know, if they're already moving over to decentralized platform, Rumble, that was the other video service. That one's getting pretty popular. If they're already moved over, then they've kind of already probably been awoken to that, if that makes sense. So we're going to be talking about that, and also some more about phones and GrapheneOS, as well as social media tracking, location tracking, spoofing your MAC address. Your MAC address is the address that's tied to your device. It could be a phone, it could be a network card in a computer. It's a unique number, and anytime you can anonymize that, especially if you're using like public Wi-Fi, the more you can obfuscate where you were and what networks you were using, if that can change. So we're going to talk about the kind of those types of things. I know the previous one, we've talked a lot about Briar and Kutch, which are kind of, you know, peer-to-peer applications that allow people to communicate even without internet connection or a centralized server to utilize. And if a lot of this techie talk sounds over your head, I understand. And I want you to just hang in there, because sometimes we're going a little deep on things and it may not seem applicable right now or applicable to you, but there might come a time, or you might find yourself in a place where you start realizing like, hey, I should probably understand these technologies a little bit better. I should understand what peer-to-peer means, what decentralized means, and how it benefits individuals when they're basically all kind of being consolidated, all of their lives, their digital lives are being consolidated to a handful of centralized authority, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, or other social media platforms or communication platforms. And what can we do to pave the way to move towards decentralized options? And when I say decentralized, I kind of use that word a lot. And I don't think that everything needs to be decentralized. But when it comes to freedom of information, one-on-one or one-to-many communication, I think it's really important, because just like Bitcoin, you can't shut it down by shutting down one server, one location, or even one country. Now, you might be able to impede and interfere, but you can't take the whole thing down. You can't take the Tor network down with just a switch. you would have to make sure all the exit nodes were turned off. That would be fantastically complicated because anyone could run a Tor relay or a Tor exit node. You could run it on a Raspberry Pi. You know, it's like it's too big to shut down. You'd have to shut the internet down. You'd have to shut down power grids. Then you have much bigger problems. So when we talk about peer-to-peer and decentralization and the importance of that, it's to protect our freedoms and protect our freedom of speech and the freedom to share thoughts and ideas with one another without waiting for the algorithm to see something that we're saying and that they don't like. Algorithms are programmed by people, and those requirements are defined by business and technical people within those institutions. So with the case with like Twitter or YouTube, if you're making content that they don't like, the algorithm will detect that and then suppress that information. So it's a way to escape that and allow individuals to communicate and express their ideas, as extreme as they may be, without it being, you know, shuttered away because of an algorithm update. I'm working on building out a new website and some applications that the listeners of this podcast can connect on. I've been playing around with setting up a Matrix server. We might do a Mastodon server. Going to be building out a new website. It's going to be a different domain name. I think sometimes the closed network, how I spell network, it's a little frustrating for people, and I totally get that. So as I work on those over the next few weeks, it's been a few weeks I've been working on it. It takes a lot of time to set this stuff up. I will, you know, provide updates on that. In the meantime, you can go to closednwrk.com to shoot me an email. Also follow on Twitter, which is just twitter.com/closednwrk. I'm also setting up some alternate accounts for Mastodon and some of these other video platforms, but I will also be doing some video content on YouTube that is a good place to reach people, but also is a great place for me to demonstrate sometimes visually what I'm saying, because I know it's hard, especially when we're talking about technical implementation or configuration of a phone or something like that. It can be kind of hard to only do that through audio, but I'm trying to grow to those things as it makes sense and not try to be on every platform and all that kind of stuff in like one shot. I really want to focus in on the areas that, you know, that really I think are important for people. I want everything to be small and easy to consume implement stuff into their life. But I also know that sometimes it's easier for it to make sense when you can see something visually, if it is appropriate. So those are the things I'm working on. I think I'll continue doing these episodes with the Hated One. I really, really like it. I enjoy it. I'm going to have my brother on soon as well and give an update. He's still rocking Calyx OS on a Pixel 4. He's been running Linux now for quite probably about 6 months or so is his main driver. Now, he uses, you know, Windows at work and stuff like that, but in personal life, he's been trying to move away from a lot of these centralized services and big tech companies to manage his data and do it himself. So I'm going to have him on in the next couple episodes and talk about where he's at with his journey. Had a great conversation, like I mentioned earlier, with my mom yesterday, and she's now kind of switching over to using a MySudo phone number for her interactions, because this whole text spam thing kind of started getting annoying. Even she tried to block the people and then text her from different numbers. And so I just want to iterate that it is a journey. Everything I talk about is not something that you should try to put on yourself to do immediately. Some people might, and that's cool. I applaud you for that. But a lot of this is step by step to unplug from the matrix and take back your sovereignty by managing your own data, understanding the trade-offs for the services that you use, and look at actually paying for services that you've been used to getting for free that also support the open source movement, open source, the privacy movement. And it is kind of a movement. It is kind of an activist movement. That's why this legislation is necessary, because businesses have basically run amok with not having any real recourse for getting hacked or selling your information. It's just part of the business model. And so when we stand up and say, I'm not gonna participate in that anymore, the more and more people that do that, the more that they hopefully will shape up and get their act together and understand that, you know, we actually care about this stuff. We care about our freedoms and our privacy. So having said that, thank you for listening. Thank you for the people that have been donating on the Lightning Network using the Podcast 2.0 apps. I get tickled every time my phone vibrates and my server tells me, hey, you know, you just got another streamed Satoshis, you know, to the podcast. It's all really helpful, and I really appreciate it. I really appreciate the people that take the time to leave a review for the podcast, whether it's on your, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Google, leaving a review there, anywhere is super appreciated. I do accept donations, and I am going to be looking at setting up Patreon. I've been trying to give it a lot of thought, and I'm still on the fence about it, but I think that it might be a good way to help continue growing this particular podcast in a way that I want to be directly supported by listeners. I want the listeners to produce the scale of this show, whether it, you know, goes to more video, more frequency of podcasts, reviewing hardware, being able to spend more time investigating, and also reaching out and interviewing people that are work in the space that provide a lot of these tools for us to utilize. So I do have plans to grow this podcast into something bigger, but I didn't want to rush out the gate to just try to set all that stuff up. I really wanted to see how well this would be received, and it's really important to me that I don't get any support from anyone else other than the listeners of this podcast. So donations or Patreon seem like the best way to go. And that way too, people know that anything I talk about or recommend is from purely just my own experience or my view about something and not influenced by a sponsorship. I know sponsorships and all these things, sometimes they're a necessary evil to grow big projects and things. And I get it. And I'm not really talking about that or using affiliate links and stuff. One of the reasons I don't like to use the affiliate links, I've thought about them and putting them in the show notes, you know, with a disclaimer. But some of these affiliates, they actually tell you like who signed up for the service. They'll actually, which is, you know, a way, is an indicator if you're a content creator and you use affiliate links for, say, something like a VPN service or something. They'll actually give you a report of who signed up. And I'm like, am I thinking that's kind of an invasion of privacy? Like, that should not be the case. And honestly, too, I don't know. I'd rather only be supported by you, the listener. And if you can support, great. If you can't, then, you know, totally get it. Maybe you can leave a review or just share the episodes with friends and family. So anyways, I won't be down that road too much longer. I will have links to the website if you do wish to support. I will also have a link to where you can download Podcast 2.0 apps. You can load it up with some Bitcoin and stream Satoshis to your favorite podcasters that are on Podcasting 2.0. It's a great way to anonymously contribute on a decentralized platform. And I absolutely love seeing those little Satoshis flow in. I really appreciate it. So I guess I will probably have two episodes out this week. This is Monday, April 11th. So I'll probably have a couple episodes out this week and then have another one out next week on normal timeline. So thanks for listening, and I will catch you in episode 15. Take care, everybody. I never quit because I know that every loss may lead to another win. I'm going up. I bet when I land, they're going to tell me it's luck again. See that I'm winning, it's harder to watch. I'm setting the stage. You should give me my prize. You ain't got a soul. You